Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch.
So welcome to another episode of the Science of Sport podcast with myself, Mike Finch, and Professor Ross Tucker. And we've had quite a bit of interest and excitement around our recent series on fatigue, and we hope that you've enjoyed it. If you look at the last two podcasts that we put out, one was on a general sort of view of fatigue, and then the one we did just over a week ago is the one on fatigue resistance. And we've had quite a lot of discussion around that, so thank you very much for your comments. And today we're going to be tackling a subject which is close to the hearts, I think, of many parents out there. Going to be discussing some of the issues with a person who knows a lot about the skeletal system of young athletes. We talk about the maturation of those athletes and how they and when they should be used, and all those sort of interesting parts around young athletes. So keep an eye on for that as we get into the main subject a bit later on our podcast. But before we do that, I know Ross has got a couple of caught my eyes. The only thing that's sort of caught my eye in a massive way in the last couple of weeks, if I can kick things off, is the name of Tadej Pogacar, who seems to be dominating the classic season in Europe at the moment. And I know we've discussed, you know, a lot about Pogacar, but watching him ride across the various classics, he's won three of them, and just seems to be imperious in a way that I've never seen a cyclist. And I think I heard a comment by one of the commentators saying when they were watching a couple of days ago, we were watching Flèche Wallonne, which he won up that final big climb at the Muir de Hoy. And he just rode away from people at will at times. And he seems to be in another level compared to no other rider out there. You look at Tom Pidcock, who's obviously in the height of his career, still not able to stay with him on some of the climbs. And he just seems to be so much better than anybody. It almost makes it boring, because if he's in the race, he's probably going
to
win it.
Yeah, I mean, I planned to do an indoors ride on Zwift yesterday as a Flèche Wallonne watch party, you know, yes. So I sit there and watch this race. And I promise my indoor ride was more entertaining than that race.
Yeah.
It is a little bit, but I mean, it obviously is mightily impressive. And I was looking at some of the stats now. If he wins on Sunday, the last monument of this season, then he becomes, I think, Philippe Gilbert David Rebellin won them all three, those, the Ardennes classics. Mm. None of them came close to winning Flanders.
Mm. So he's won Flanders, Amstel Gold, and Flèche Wallonne just a couple of days ago from us doing this podcast.
Yeah, and then remember he won Paris-Nice, yeah. He's won all the other stage races. I think he's at 68% of the races he started this year, he's won.
Yeah.
And his career is 24%. I saw that stat as well, ridiculous.
Watching him going up that climb when he pulled ahead of Tom Pidcock on the Amstel Gold race is just absolutely insane. I mean, he literally just rode him off the wheel.
That performance was probably, Flèche Wallonne was pretty dull, and often is actually. Like, everyone just waits for the last 1.2K.
It's incredible.
But that Amstel Gold performance, because one by one, I mean, attack first, then the group, attack again, drop it. Now it's three, then drop Peely, then drop Pidcock. I mean, it's just, it's like shooting fish in a barrel for the guy. So that said, winning these races as a climber is not unusual, like David Rebellin and so on. But it's the Flanders that makes it remarkable, I think. Like the fact that, you know, the guys who are in contention in Flanders to challenge him don't even race these ones. Mm. You will not see Mads Pedersen and these guys at the top of the Muir de Huy and Amstel Gold, right? So he's winning on both terrains, literal cobbles, flat, the tarmac, the kills, the flat rides. Well, relatively, I mean, Flanders obviously is bumpy. Mm. But it would be interesting to actually like unpack the physiology of that. Like why is he able to do that when no one else has been able to do it in the modern era, you know?
Because he can climb with the best. He's a puncher. in the same vein as Matteo van der Poel, although they often don't compete against each other. Mm. When they do, Pogacar wins.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, it is amazing that he's, I mean, they talk about him, comparing him to Eddie Merckx, you know, wanting to win everything, whether it's a long stage race or it's a classic, and he's able to do that. He is another Eddie Merckx.
And of course, those comparisons are tricky because the degree of professionalism and competitiveness back then is completely different now. It's arguably much more difficult to be a generalist now than it was then. Yeah, so anyway, it's because he must have, we know from the Tour de France performances that between 20 and 30 minutes, he's the best.
Yeah.
I'd suggest that from 30 minutes over, Vingegaard showed that he's better.
Yes,
and he has done a couple times. Even though he didn't win the Tour, he put him in trouble, I remember, on Mont Ventoux. Mm-hmm. So that seems to be like where Pogacar starts to like lose the stronghold at the number one spot, but not by much, right? But then you come down and you say 15 minutes, okay, he's winning those climbs. 10 minutes, he's dominant. The Quaremont and the Paterberg are 1 to 2 minutes long. Mm. Okay, maybe the Quaremont's a little longer, it's just over 2Ks. But he's as good as the specialist. So the range, so his power duration curve must look like the best parts of the long distance, the long specialists in the mountains, and the best parts of the short, and he's connecting the two, and that's never been done.
Yeah, and it's interesting because he's got interesting ways of riding. Like his handlebars are quite narrow compared to a lot of the pros. I read some of the setups on his bikes. He's got narrow handlebars. He seems to have a very high cadence compared to some of those big puncher type riders. When he's going up those climbs, his cadence is high, whereas some of the bigger riders, Van der Poel and co, are pushing relatively big gears. So he's obviously very technically very good as well.
I would imagine, seems that way. He didn't get out of the saddle on the Muerde Hee yesterday until about 100 meters to go. So everyone else was fighting the bicycles and he was not. He looked, I didn't see the performance. I don't think it was particularly fast because with 150 meters left of that climb, there were still 10 guys. Mm. Who, in theory, had a chance, but in reality had zero.
Yeah. I thought Roman Bardet might sneak it. But
yeah, so I don't know. I mean, yeah, he had to make two moves because he got blocked on the right. Yeah, but anyway, it's impressive. I don't know. I do you know my feelings on cycling, though.
We'll leave the cynics view for next week. Anyway, so Kurt Meyers, what have you got lined up there, Russ?
Yeah, so here's a cracker that I got. This was actually on Twitter, not Patreon. Normally, I'll take these on Patreon. So that's an incentive for you to sign up. You go to patreon.com/science of sports or sports science. What I didn't even remember.
Science of Sport podcast.
Thank you. Science of Sport podcast. But this one was on Twitter, and I thought it was pretty cool. It's from Mel Sykes, who finished a race recently, London to Manchester, in fourth position. Sorry, Manchester to Liverpool Ultra. Sorry, I'll get my brain in this game eventually. Manchester to Liverpool Ultra 2023 crossed the line in fourth place, was subsequently upgraded to third, because the woman who did come third was later found to have taken a car for 2.5 miles of the 50-mile race. And Mel Sykes messaged me saying, here's a caught my eye. And it was actually her post saying like she'd been promoted to third place as a consequence of this disqualification of a Polish runner. And then it kicked off yesterday. There was an article in the BBC, The Guardian, Sean Ingle ended up covering the aftermath of it. And it basically describes how this athlete traveled in a car for 2.5 miles and was then bust because in her Strava file, she covered a mile in the race in 1:40. Now, okay. And then it subsequently emerged.
It's a world record.
By a lot. It subsequently emerged that she hadn't been feeling that great. And so she hopped in a car and took the car to the next sort of water point. And she's now saying that the officials encouraged her to finish, which she then said she would do. Fine. Okay, cool. But then she still accepted the prizes and posed for the photos and everything afterwards and has called that subsequently a really bad mistake that she regrets and so forth. But
a bad error of judgment.
But then how bad is it to upload your Strava file? Knowing that people, a friend of mine messaged yesterday and she's just sort of a recreational and she says she loves looking at people's Strava files to see what's
I'm
the fastest
a smile, Strava. Yes,
look at their heart rates and so on.
Yeah.
So, this athlete... Dr. Zakrewski, Josia Zakrewski of Poland, has claimed that she had traveled a long way. She was jet-lagged, wasn't thinking straight, and as a consequence, took all the pictures, accepted the prizes, went home, uploaded the file, got caught. And I was, it was just a bad error of judgment. So, anyway, Mel Sykes. Yeah, so thanks to Mel and congratulations on your third place.
Yes.
But it kicked off some really good, funny chat actually about this, and made me think of some of the other examples. Tell us the story about the twins and comrades.
Oh yes, the Motz and I forget their name. So there was a twin, I forget the name now, but I'll put it in the show notes. But they were twins, yeah. Exactly, and they looked exactly the same. And I remember covering the story as the journalist, myself and one of the local journalists picked up the error, where at halfway one of the twins ran into a toilet cubicle where his brother was waiting, and the brother exited and carried on for the second half of the race, and suddenly this guy was in the top 10. And the only reason why they discovered that that they'd been cheating is they were wearing different colored watches. That's how they caught. One had a different colored watch in the second half, and then the other one had a different colored watch in the first half. Otherwise, they were identical.
Was it in the day of the chip timer?
Yes, it was.
So they swapped chips.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I'll put the story in the show notes because it is an absolute classic and one of the best. If I say best, it's one of the most famous cheating stories I can remember in running. But they almost got away with it.
Yeah. Was there ever a car used at Comrades?
Not that I know of. And just to go back to that story just very briefly, the guy that actually raised the alarm was a guy by the name of Nick Bester, who'd won the Comrades previously. Oh, yeah. And he said he was running along and suddenly there was this guy who was ahead of him that he hadn't seen before. And he's like wondering, where did he come from? And that's what kind of raised the alarm about, okay, hang on, there's something suspicious. And then we started looking at the pictures and whatever. Anyway. Yeah, so I've never heard of a car at Comrades, because you can imagine back in the day that was probably a very good opportunity because there were big gaps between the runners in the sort of 40s and 30s, 40s, 50s.
And the Comrades sort of followed the route parallel to the main highway, so yeah, you could do it.
You could easily do it. But I've never heard of it at Comrades actually happening, but surprisingly not, to be honest.
It just isn't known, maybe.
Yeah.
It's like doping. It's there. It's just
I'm actually going to look it up on my phone because I now need to know what the name is going to bother me.
Another one I remember also having used a car is a guy called Rob Young was trying to break the record for running across the USA from the West Coast to the East Coast.
Yes, I remember this.
And a bunch of Let's Run followers raised the flag on this guy because he was promoting where he'd be so that people could come tag along. And then one night someone came and ran with him, planned to run with him, and saw the camper van and know Rob Young. And so this then kicked off all these sort of amateur sleuths. And eventually the guy who was sponsoring Young, a guy called Jamie Fuller of Skins, contacted me and another guy to say, will we be able to look into this if he gets us access to Rob Young's data files? And the reason I bring it up is because Rob Young was very happy for us to look at his watch records, all his files, TomTom records and so forth, which strikes me it's the same as this athlete now, like uploading the file. I don't know whether they don't think about it or whether they are so convinced that they'll get away with it anyway. I mean, you can't be if you're her. You know you've done a mile in like a minute 40. And Rob Young was the same. There were periods on that run. It wasn't outrageous, but there were a couple of periods when he was doing 50K an hour for a few hundred meters.
Mm-hmm.
And there were other moments when it was like just inconceivably fast relative to the rest of the run. And so by the time we got hold of the data, it became very obvious. And I remember we said, okay, what's the best metric? It's not always speed, because If you're clever about it in the car, you'll drive the car at sort of 12K an hour, 5 minutes a K, and you'll say I was running.
Mm.
So we eventually decided on using his cadence record from the watch and his speed to work out step length, because that's what you basically get. If you're running 5 minutes a K and you're taking 90 steps a minute, you should be taking, 450 strides per minute.
Yes.
And so we looked at that.
Where this is going.
And we plotted it. And it was amazing because night runs, his average step length was like 20 meters. Daytime runs, 1.1 meters. And in these two populations of nighttime runs and daytime runs separated out like oil and water. And we just plotted this on a graph, and it was so obvious that the guy must have been in the car or on the back of the car or something for long, long periods, but only ever at night. It was clear as day, if you'll pardon the mixing of day and night. And eventually we published that and off he went.
Jeez. I just looked up the names of the brothers. It was Sergio and Fika Motsaneng in 1999, and they finished ninth in that race until they were eventually busted. They got 6,000 Rand, which is about $500 in prize money that they lost in the process. But yeah, good story.
But notorious in
notorious
history.
Indeed.
Yeah, then anyway, speaking of running, did you watch Boston on Monday?
Oh, man. That was fantastic. Evans Chebet. I mean,
yeah, the races always, were good. The women's race was also really good. The
women's race was really good. And I think what made me a little bit sad is that Runner's World in the US, their story was the fact that Kipchoge didn't win. And they didn't necessarily celebrate the fact that Evans Chebet is arguably the number one marathoner in the world now.
Yeah. I mean, on the television coverage, I don't know what it's like where you are in the world listening to this, but once Kipchoge got dropped, there was a split screen, Kipchoge and the men.
Yes.
It was ridiculous. Like, and we know he's coming eighth. In the end, he finished sixth. Just, I was really surprised at how almost meekly he went off the back. I mean, the moment the pace went up, he was just drifting backwards. It was weird.
The strange thing is, and I guess it's when you look at the way he's run in the past, he's always had the pace setters. We've discussed this in the podcast before. There is no doubt, and there is a change now in marathon running around the world where these use of pace setters is becoming less and less prevalent. And Boston is one of those races where there are no pace setters. Mm. It's a race and the best person wins. It's not about pace setting. So Kipchoge was on the front. Literally everybody was behind him. He was the favorite. Everybody was pacing off him. And I think what's interesting in that is that his dynamic when he's run really fast races is that he has had these pace setters. Now all of a sudden he's on his own. Yeah, he has done at the Olympics, of course,
sort of.
Too.
That's the point I was going to make. Two of his most dominant wins were the Olympic Games.
Yeah, true.
But the difference, I think, because I had the same thoughts watching it, is this guy must have learned from all those sub-2 gimmicks that you don't sit in the front. And there was a headwind in Boston for big parts of that course.
I don't think he had a choice, to be honest. Nobody was willing to go past him.
Of course he did. They would have just run 2:09.
Yeah,
but that's the problem. He wanted to go to Boston and run 2:04. And then he had to take the lead. So he wanted to have his cake and eat it too. He wanted fast. And you know what I mean? So he finds himself doing exactly what the sub-2 thing should have taught him not to do, which is, I think, a little bit of hubris, in my opinion. And then the moment, he was way too fast early in Boston. The first sort of 5K was like 14:18 or something. And it is downhill. But the hills of Boston hurt the legs. Yeah. We in South Africa know that because nothing around here is flat. Mm-hmm. It's not like Berlin. Even the Olympic marathons, I think, are a little flatter. Paris is not, so that sets up an interesting Paris marathon if he can get himself in 15 months into some sort of shape again. But, it was strange to me to see him on the front. He obviously thought he could lead solo for 2 hours and 5 minutes and win a race against really good guys, and that just seems to me to be, a little overconfident. And then I subsequently saw he said he was bothered by a leg issue. And they said to him, do you think that the pace on the downhills contributed to it? Not at all, he says. He's asked whether the course, which is hillier than the other 17 marathons he's raced, challenged him. He says, there's no challenge. My training actually is all round. It can accommodate hill, up and down, or flat. There's no challenge at all, says the guy who got beaten by 5 other people. He's a fabulous marathon runner, but I find this shtick a bit tiresome, to be honest with you. Like just recognize that you were challenged, whether by the course or by the 5 other guys. This whole transcendent marathoner shtick actually tires me. But anyway,
I think when you're having, excuse the phrase, having smoke blown up your bum every 5 minutes by everybody who wants to know, it's very difficult to maybe move away from that. And I kind of, you get that sense.
That's what I think.
He's lauded and, he's the goat and everybody talks about him like that. So I guess it's hard to humble yourself in that situation when everybody's being up there.
So anyway, I saw that. I was just, you could actually just say you were beaten, you had a bad day or something.
Yeah, for sure. So he's only won. So the only two marathons he hasn't won is obviously Boston and New York.
Yeah.
Of the majors, every other one he's won.
Did he do? I don't know if it's Chicago. I'm not sure that he's won one in the US. I stand corrected.
No, I think he's won. He's won 5 of the 7. Is that right?
I stand corrected, but I didn't think that he'd won Chicago. So, as you can tell, folks, we don't do much prep. But just on the Boston Marathon, the women's race came down, and I was sort of chuckling silently to myself because when we recorded our last podcast on durability and fatigue resistance, we used Helen O'Berry as an example. And sure enough, there was Helen O'Berry with 1 mile to go and company in the form of, it would have been 2 or 3 other athletes. And of course, the commentators now start talking about Helen O'Berry's track speed, which makes the difference, but only because Helen O'Berry is legitimately a 2:16:17 marathon potential, so she's really good. And that was a good race.
So he has won Chicago 2014. So he's won Chicago, Berlin, London, and Tokyo. Just Boston and New York await him. So 2014 was Chicago. So that was his first marathon major actually that he won. So there we are. Research on the fly.
Because I remember since then, it's been Boston for a world record every year and London for a big flat fast race.
Yeah.
And so he's tried to break that, and which I think is also commendable, by the way, like to try and tick all of them off and win races of different kinds. And also makes some strategic sense, because if you're going to win Paris with its hills, I would suggest you'd want to run New York and Boston at least a couple times before that.
Yeah.
So that's probably, well, I don't know, we'll see.
38 is probably the latter part of his career.
And that's the thing. I've been waiting for 4 or 5 years to see the decline, and it hasn't come. It hasn't come. Maybe it's finally come. I don't know. But
in a way, and I'm not saying I wish bad luck on him, because he is a true great. But in a way, if he dominated and won all the majors, got the course record at every single one of the majors, it kind of, I don't know, you almost want him not to do that. A bit like Tiger Woods, everybody was saying he was going to beat Jack Nicklaus's record for the number of majors, and probably never will now.
Mm-mm.
But when they're lauded like that and they don't quite get that, shows you what those records are like. It's not that easy.
But like Tadej Pogačar.
Well, yes. Will he win everything for years?
All of them. And then, exactly.
The way he's going, he is.
I mean, he win Liège, Bastogne-Liège, maybe probably the Tour, pick up the world title.
He's got to beat the human skeleton at the Tour, so, you know, that's Vingegaard.
Yeah. And then a final one that caught my eye in the context of Boston was, there was some chat about the woman who came fifth in their race, Emma Bates.
Yes, what a race she had, man.
Yeah, and Cara Gacha was commenting on Twitter saying that she's got the most perfect form for running a marathon and the most efficient looking technique. She must have the best running economy.
Yeah,
and then Trent Stellingworth, who,
as opposed to Obiri, who looks like she's overstriding.
And
this is
the interesting thing, is I almost guarantee that Obiri and Bates are the same running economy. And the point is that you can't visually judge it. And so Trent Stellingworth replied on Twitter to make that point, is that we don't really know what makes good running economy. And we get like a little bit drunk on aesthetics, and it's not all there. So a study that he then linked to was published in the European Journal of Sports Science in 2021, and it's called Visual Classification of Running Economy by Distance Running Coaches. And what they did was they had 5 runners come in with running economies that were close together but different, so ranging between 40 and 50 mils per kilogram per minute. And then they had 121 coaches make an assessment and rank them from 1 to 5, best to worst running economy. And 35% of the coaches scored 0. Okay. Not a single person ranked in the right place.
But what? How do you judge economy? I'll get to that.
Okay. I just want to give you the results, right? Because this is how bad we are. And these were good coaches. Eh? These are from international, college, high school level coaches.
Mm-hmm.
35%, 0 out of 5 ranked right. 47% got 1 out of 5, 12% got 2 out of 5, and 6% 3 out of 5. Not a single person could get 4 or 5 out of 5. I suppose if you're going to get 4, you're going to get 5, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then they say to the coaches, what sort of stuff are you looking at? And so the coaches come up with these lists, and they include things like negatives would be, let me just read this to you here. Negatives would be greater vertical displacement or bounce. If you show that, you've got low running economy. Heel striking, footfall pattern, high body mass, lateral transverse movement of the arms across the body, thinking of Berry now,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
High arm carriage, again thinking of Berry, greater forward lean, overstriding. On the good side, listed as good for running economy, higher stride rate, midfoot or forefoot, footfall under the center of gravity, and greater forward lean. So some coaches listed forward lean as good, some listed it as bad, to illustrate the point. But the point is that we don't, I think we get biased a little bit on symmetry and compactness, and we think that's what makes efficiency. And it's, I think the efficiency is probably inside the body, and it's not necessarily on the outside.
But physically, if you look at Helena Berry, she's got this big sort of loping stride. She comes from a very strong track background. Mm. But she's got this long, looks inefficient because she's taking longer strides, whereas you look at the American and she's got these short sort of, and physically I hear what you're saying, but you know, physiologically that Iberi is not looking as efficient. Surely that is reasonable to say that she's not as efficient. She might be cardiovascularly stronger, which obviously proved to be on the day, but even visually you can't judge that.
No, and that's why this paper concludes, and this is the coaching message, is practically coaches should be cautious when recommending biomechanical adjustments without considering the interconnected factors related to such changes. So you could say, I'm going to fix a beer, I'm going to make it even better by changing that arm movement and getting her to look more compact, but that might kick off some chain of things that ultimately cancels out and even overrides. But like a Berry could run a 2:16 marathon, if not faster. I mean, they were Boston course.
Yes, she's got a track record.
It wasn't the perfect conditions and so on. So, and she's got a half marathon performance in the 65s, maybe even faster than that. So she will have a running economy that is as good as any other athletes in the world. I mean, it's not, that's for sure. Those top five will all be really, really similar in my opinion. That's why they're there. So if the best prediction of whether your running economy is high is how fast you are. So you know she's going to be. Anyway, I thought it was really interesting is that we should be a little bit cautious about judging a book by its cover, as it were.
Well, she's a two-time Olympic 5,000-meter champion and at the Olympic Games. So, I mean, she's clearly got the class. So you're right. Maybe we are judging form wrongly.
Yeah, exactly.
Or we all do, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, and then you could have made the same case for Paula Radcliffe's head.
Yes.
And there's a number of athletes. I mean, Kipchoge also looks incredibly symmetrical and compact, and he obviously does have really good running economy. But the guy from Tanzania who ended up second, looks more loping like. But that's, again, we have these ideas of what it should look like, and we can't necessarily see. Because remember, it's determined by metabolic efficiency, ultimately. Because it's what's the demand at the level of the muscle on a cellular level. That's what determines the running economy. And I think we look at it more crudely from outside, and it's actually inside.
Yeah, interesting one. Right, so let's get on to our subject of our podcast today. And our guest today is a gentleman by the name of Eirik Halvorsen Wiik, who is a Norwegian researcher based here in Stellenbosch. He's here for a while, and he comes from the Institute of Sport and Exercise Medicine in Stellenbosch University. And his focus is very much on youth development, and particularly when talking not about necessarily sport development, but actually physiological development of them. So fascinating talking to him, because he really gives us a great insight, first of all, into how boys and girls mature differently, and also the challenges of early maturing athletes versus late maturing athletes.
Yeah, so I know him through Stellenbosch because I'm also affiliated with the same department as him. And he approached us earlier this year because he's doing this research that he mentions in our chat with him, where he's using this novel ultrasound technique to measure skeletal age. Why would you want to know skeletal age? Well, stick around, because he'll tell you three main reasons for it. And so he pitched this proposal to the athletes that I work with in Nest EnduroCAD Academy. And we discussed it, and we eventually decided that we wouldn't go with it because we weren't 100% sure of its benefits and so on. Then I bumped into him and I spent 20 minutes chatting with him, and I thought, no, this is actually, this stuff's too interesting not to do. So we pitched it back to the coaches again in the form of a session that Eirik did with them, where he explained what we titled "What Every Coach Needs to Know About Maturation and Growth in Young Athletes." And it is so fascinating because it's like a piece of the puzzle. It's more than just a piece of the puzzle. Sometimes it's almost like the foundation on which the puzzle gets built. Is this is a 15-year-old, but how mature are they really physically? Not all 15-year-olds are the same, and it's not just genetics that makes them different. Some of them are equivalent to 12, and some of them equivalent to 18. It's remarkable. And then injury risk flows from that. Your talent ID and your selection flows from that. Your performance capabilities come out of that. So if you are a parent or coach of a young athlete and you don't have at least some understanding, it doesn't mean you have to act on it necessarily, but you have to know that it's there, this concept of difference in biological growth, you're effectively guessing what's going to happen next. And so it's for me, a fascinating part of the whole picture of how we bring up and manage young athletes. Really good.
So one of the things that we're going to put on our social media is just a little diagram that comes from a presentation that Eirik put in, which shows you the growth, normal growth amongst girls and boys, which we'll do on our social media. And it's very interesting to see as we get into that discussion exactly how things are different between those two sexes. But here he is, our guest for today. So, Eirik, welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. It's always nice to have a Norwegian, what is the area up there called? Nordic accent. We were talking about this a little bit before you
love the accent.
You joined. We love the accent because it kind of feels like the kind of accent you want to listen to as you go to sleep at night. It's a very peaceful accent. So it's lovely to have you here with us in the studio as well, which is great, not via Zoom or anything like that. Welcome. I know you're based in Stellenbosch at the moment in Cape Town, is that right?
Yeah, correct.
Just tell us what you're doing now.
So I'm working as a postdoctoral researcher. So it's essentially it's like a temporary research position where you get a bit free reins to explore your own research and essentially practice being a better researcher in within the topics you like. So I'm with the Institute of Sport and Exercise Medicine at Stellenbosch University, led by Prof. Wayne Derman. So yeah, very lucky to be here and spent a year and a half already trying to set some projects up.
And are you a runner or a cyclist or anything like that? What do you do in your spare time when you're not researching?
I think earlier I would have said I was a football player. Now I'm more of a triathlete. So okay. Mostly running, cycling, swimming, and some gym work.
So do you go with all those guys that train at Stellenbosch University? They've got, I know Flora Duffy sometimes is there training, isn't she?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm quite that level. Yeah, I'm very recreational, but training with the Stellenbosch Triathlon Squad, so that's good support there. Yeah.
It's great fun. A good place to be when you're training, I suppose. A good place to do research, I guess, as well.
Yeah, it is, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell us about your journey to there, because I know you've come, you're moving from north to south.
Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, I guess I've always been interested in sports. In Norway, we have this like sports high school program where you're doing proper high school, but you also get to focus on sports subjects like physiology and coaching and stuff like that.
In high school?
In high school, yeah.
Really?
So you get your qualifications to go to university, but you can add on some subjects that I found very interesting at that age. And from there, I went to study at the Norwegian School of Sports Sciences. So I think I went in not really knowing, I guess most sports scientists, you go in because you're passionate about it and you like it, but you don't really know what it's going to lead to. Eventually did a master's degree in exercise physiology, 1 year teaching degree before I started my PhD in Qatar through the same university in Norway. So
what was your PhD on?
So it was on injuries in youth football and athletics and how growth and maturity may affect the risk of sustaining an injury.
Okay. Yeah. Kind of that's what we're going to be talking about a bit today.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting is there's a Norwegian School of Sports Sciences. I mean, that must be one of the few places in the world where you've actually got a whole institute focused on schools sports science, isn't it? I mean, I can't think of another country that has that.
Yeah, and I don't know, but it's really a unique setting. It's a really beautiful place as well. And you've got, obviously, lots of people who enjoy sports, but you know, all different directions. You have sociology, you have the psychology, and physical education, performance, all of those things. So it's a really nice place, and it's right next to the Olympic Training Center. So you have a lot of expertise, like in a very focused area there.
Well, it's interesting when I think about Norwegians, I just think of guys doing cross-country skiing, and that's all you do. I mean, and biathlon, of course.
Yeah.
What are the major sports in Norway? I mean, what do they teach at school? What do they play?
Yeah, so I think you're right with the cross-country skiing. That's kind of our thing.
National pastime.
Yeah, so, you know, everyone goes out when 1 or 2 years old, and, you know, you go with your parents, and then you more or less like it, but you're forced to. some people like it more than others, and then you go through a phase where you might not like it that much, and then you rediscover it for yourself. So, but obviously that's a very seasonal sport, so it's mainly January to March, maybe April. But I think football or soccer is probably the main sport, along with handball, which isn't that common down here, but it's a very popular sport in Norway.
Got a couple of triathlon champions.
Yeah.
Yes. That's true.
Maybe it's become more popular after that. I wouldn't say it was very popular probably when they started. So,
In fact, Ironman and Olympic, right?
Yeah.
Yes. I'm just trying to think of the...
Carsten Blumenfeld and then Eden.
Yeah.
So that's both ends of the triathlon spectrum covered. Plus a really good 400-meter hurdler.
And a golf player, tennis player,
true,
football player. Suddenly Norway's become
a good
really
nation.
Good.
Yes, exactly. And one of the happiest nations in the world, apparently.
Apparently.
According to the stats.
Says Eric from South Africa, where the power goes off every 2 hours.
Anyway, so let's get into the subject today. And you've led into it a little bit here. But we're going to talk a little bit about the school sports, young athletes, youth development. My first question to you is, why is it important to look at the details of youth and sport development?
Well, I think we've got to kind of always try to keep the angle in mind, and that angle can be a bit different depending on who you are. Some might want to participate in sports because it's fun and they just want to enjoy it. Others have very serious, you know, performance goals, or they want to reach the top level. And then maybe from a societal level, you want to teach people to be active and enjoy lifelong participation in physical activity. So I think for everyone, everyone would be interested in keeping athletes active for as long as possible to reach those goals, whatever they are.
And so, I mean, just give us an idea of where your interest is specifically in this sort of youth development area.
Yeah, so I'm quite interested in the variations that happen in the adolescent years. So typically from 10, maybe up to 19 years, where there's so much going on at different times, and people grow and they mature at different rates. And there's just so much happening. And it's actually really fascinating when we look at how much that can affect things like injury risk and performance and selection to teams. So I think my passion came a bit, maybe I've always been coaching youth teams. I enjoyed that. But it's also like it's a topic everyone can relate to in a way. Like everyone has their own story. I was the classic late developer, so I wasn't very tall at 15, 16, but then grew quite tall.
And you're tall now, just for those
I can use that as an excuse for not making it as a footballer. It's definitely not the reason, but
the thing about it is that we've set up, for better or worse, and usually for worse, a system that makes its most important selections and decisions at exactly the time of people's lives that they're changing the most in sport. So the trajectory, the path that you one day as a 25-year-old look back on and say, 10 years ago, the following three things happened to me. Those three things happened to you at a time that you were changing rapidly, and so were all your peers. And so I suppose, and we've discussed this on the podcast before, right? It's the gambling mindset where you're basically putting bets on people before you know where the chips are going to land. You know what I mean? And that's why it's so important, I think, to understand exactly what's happening in that time so that you can make those gambles or those educated guesses in a more educated way, right? That's the point here, is can we be better at making decisions? And that includes talent ID and then what you do once you've selected your talent.
And I mean, we're going to talk a lot, of course, about the physiology, which is your area of speciality. But I mean, one of the things which we often don't consider is the emotional maturity of these athletes as well. I mean, I don't know whether you can comment on that, because it's an area where, you know, hormones are going mad at that point for girls. It's a big change in their life. For boys, a bit late development and a slightly later development than girls. But there's a lot of emotional stuff happening there that people often don't take into account.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I'm in no way an expert on the psychology of it. It's more I know of. I don't really know it. But yeah, you're right. Like, it's typically associated with more risk-taking behavior and more of you place more importance on your peers rather than, your forward planning abilities might not be as developed as they will later on. So there's definitely a big psychological component to it as well.
So let's kick off with some of the details. Now, one of the examples that I heard a while back was talking about the fact that a 13, 14-year-old female athlete is probably the most efficient body type you can get, because they are still light, they've matured a little bit more than the boys, and they are super good at 13, 14. That's why we see a lot of, in South Africa in particular, we see a lot of 13, 14, 15-year-old girls really doing well in athletics. And then they get to 19, 20, 21 when they've matured and they're suddenly not as good as they used to be. Just comment a little bit about, from your research, how boys and girls develop differently and the process that those levels happen at.
Yeah, so it's most of this knowledge isn't necessarily from my research, but there's been really good studies going on. Like, to do this properly is a very difficult area, so you have to follow kids ideally, from before puberty to after puberty, which you can imagine is really difficult.
Yeah.
So, but you have some good research projects that have done that in the past, and that's where a lot of this knowledge is coming from. And I mean, the key, I guess, is that growth isn't linear. So, you don't develop at the same rate throughout your adolescent years. And that those changes are a bit different from boys to girls in general. Like, there will be lots of inter-individual variation, of course, but on average, there are these differences between boys and girls. And to your point about the 14-year-old female athlete, I guess it's a very specific example. Maybe it's true for athletics, but I think it's also quite sports specific. But yeah, there might be that element that they've gone further, but than the boys at that point.
Perhaps. So girls do develop physically ahead of boys. Is that right?
Approximately 2 years is kind of the rule of thumb. Yeah.
Can you, just to take a step back, can you define growth as distinct from maturity, maturation?
Yeah. So if you follow what's kind of accepted in the literature now, Bob Molina wrote a really nice book along with some colleagues on growth, maturation, physical activity. And they define growth as a change in size. So either of the whole body or a body part. So it's quite a simple, in a way, a concept, where it's just a change in, say, its height or leg length or body mass. And then maturity is a bit different. So that's like a progress towards a mature state or adult state. You're kind of going from being a child to being an adult. And that depends on the different organ systems that are involved. So you might look at different indicators and things happen a bit, not necessarily at the same time for everyone there.
Mm. And what is when you talk about that growth, how do you know when somebody has reached a state of maturity versus somebody that is still getting there? How do you know that?
So it depends on the system. So typically in sports and exercise science, you've used three main organ systems: the skeletal system, the sexual or sexual maturity, and the somatic system. So if you look at sexual maturity is when you have a full reproductive function. That's the definition of the mature state.
Mm-hmm.
And typically you use pubertal stages, such as the Tanner staging, probably more known as, where you can say, okay, this is where puberty starts. And then you reach the end point where, okay, now we're done with this development. And then, or maturity. And then you have the skeletal system. It's a bit difficult or different. So you have the skeleton pretty much going from cartilage to like calcified, ossified bone. So that's how you define a mature skeleton, is when it's gone from cartilage to bone. And then the somatic maturity would be you've reached your adult height. So when you plateau and you don't grow anymore, that's your adult or mature state.
And so do those systems operate together? In other words, if you've reached sexual maturity and your height is where it's going to be and it's plateaued, therefore is your skeletal system then mature? Does it all work linear, or does the skeletal maturation happen ahead of the other two systems?
No, so they do operate differently. Going into details, I wouldn't know necessarily exactly what it is, but it does operate a bit differently. And you'll see that different landmarks, such as like reaching your peak height velocity or where you grow the most, happens typically at the same stages of sexual maturity within most kids within a gender. But then there's also differences between genders in there. So it is a bit messy. And I think if you want to have like a really good answer to this, you probably need a pediatrician who studies this specifically.
I mean, the reason why I asked that, using the example of those 13, 14-year-old girls that are potentially not sexually mature at that point, but seem to be physically very mature compared to their male counterparts, is that that seems to be quite common.
I suspect sexual maturation happens quite in advance of the skeleton.
Yeah, I am. You're putting me on the spot here. Honestly, I don't feel too confident
talking about
sports
here. And sexual maturation is irrelevant to the purposes of sports. So, but you did mention one there about peak height velocity, and that peak height velocity became really central to everything in youth development. They used it as a talent ID tool. They were using it as a training guide when we should load the skeleton more and so forth. Maybe you can just explain a little bit about what that concept means for people who haven't heard of it and aren't familiar with how to maybe optimize it.
Yeah, so I mean, peak height velocity is essentially the time where the growth rate is the fastest. So it means you're gaining the most within a period of time. So growth rates can be around 10 to 12 centimeters within a year, around that time. And in boys, that's typically around 13, 14 years, and in girls, 2 years before that. It's a marker of maturity timing. So age at peak height velocity would be an indicator of your timing of maturity. And yeah, you can use that to then classify athletes as either having going through the growth spurt, having passed it already, or having it in front of them. So that's how it's been used in practice.
So practically it was done then that you'd measure the height of a kid on the same day every year and you'd say, right, this 4 centimeters taller from 2019 to 20, then 4 centimeters from 20 to 21, and now in 22, 10 centimeters tall.
Yeah.
But you'd only know that it was the peak a year after it had occurred.
Yeah.
So how did they operationalize that?
So that's a challenge with height. If you truly want to know it, you need to follow them throughout puberty and adolescence. And requires serial measurements, more than one measure to truly find your peak. But obviously in sports, we don't have time for that. We want answers right away, preferably tomorrow. So then people have come up with estimating equations on where you can approximate where you are in relation to that peak height velocity.
And you mentioned now, so from peak height velocity, then you start to, your growth rate declines again until it eventually becomes zero. And that's when you nod your full adult height, right?
Yeah.
Is the period from peak to that point relatively consistent, or does it vary as much as the period it took to get to peak in the first place? You know what I'm saying? Is there variation beyond peak height velocity as well?
I mean, there is a variation in how long the whole growth spurt takes. I don't remember exactly how that works, but it's there definitely is some different some differences in terms of how long your growth spurt lasts as well.
What's interesting is that you talk about those three systems, but just from an outsider's perspective, I would have thought that the muscular system would be the real measure of performance based. In other words, if you could measure a 14-year-old who has a developed muscular system, that would be the first thing that would say, well, that person is going to be is ahead of their biological, their actual numerical age versus being somebody who is behind it. I mean, can you look at muscular maturation as a measure of any kind?
I think it would relate to your sexual maturity, because the development of muscle would be regulated by the sexual hormones. And
so I told her there was a relationship between that, and
we found one. Yeah. But the other thing about the muscle, I remember, is that it's really plastic; it can be changed a lot over time. So it would be more, I suspect, variable in response to the outside environment and what the person's doing. The skeleton will be, but maybe not as much. Remember Ryan Hall was a 206 marathon runner, and now he's a CrossFitter. He looks like a different human being, and that was in adulthood. So muscle would be very specific to the sport and also highly affected, I would have thought, by what you do in training. And so therefore, it's probably not a really reliable gauge of physical development independent of training, which is what you actually want, I think.
Ross was mentioning that there's a system or a way of measuring skeletal maturity. How do you go about doing that?
Yeah, so traditionally, it's been you can use X-rays, you can use MRI, and you can use ultrasound as maybe the most common ones. And I guess X-rays of the hand and wrists has been the kind of preferred one, especially in sports. So. But yeah, you'd have to go to a center with the correct equipment and a person that's trained to take the picture, and then you need someone to interpret it. You can use software for that as well now, but it's typically costly. It's not so logistically useful, and it's. It's a bit operator dependent. In addition to the radiation, which some have argued is negligible, but anytime there's radiation involved with kids, you have to be careful, and ethics committees are often a bit hesitant about approving that if it's not for clinical suspicion of some pathology. So getting it purely for a talent identification purpose or performance is a measure, then it's not so easy to get it.
Yeah, it's not feasible.
So that's why. But now there have been some developments in technology in terms of ultrasound. So we've recently got a device from that's made in Israel by a company called Sonic Bone that can measure your skeletal age by using ultrasound. So it's relatively quick, non-invasive. It gives a decent estimate, but it's still new. But from what I've seen, it looks very useful.
So give us a sense now. A 14-year-old comes in and has this measurement done. What is the range of growth and maturation difference that you might find in someone who's chronologically 14? Mm. How big a...
Typically, you see during puberty, you can have a range of 6 years in terms of biological age or skeletal age. So it means, say you have a 12-year-old, you could have a biological 9-year-old or a biological, I guess that would be 15-year-old. So 6 years in terms of biological age.
That's
the spread. Yeah. And that's profound, right? Because now you're a parent listening to this with a 12-year-old. Who's playing sports against 12-year-olds, but yours might be biologically 9, playing against 15-year-olds. And then that's where the selections are being made for who gets high school scholarships, who gets into first teams, who gets best coaching, best equipment, you know? Meanwhile, you've got 3 years to make up on your peers.
Yeah. So, I mean, the suggestion is then that if that person is ahead of the curve, the other people that are behind the curve are eventually going to catch them up when they are mature. Am I assuming that correctly?
I think like in any other, context that isn't that big of a problem, it might be related to certain psychological aspects as well. Just stuff I've heard about. But like in sports, the problem is that you might not be in the system at that point because... You know, it has really big performance effects, coaches just tend to prefer, either early or later matures, depending on the sport, really.
Yeah, and that's why it's not a maturation issue, but you know, the relative age effect, where in junior teams, children born in January, February, March are overrepresented compared to October, November, December. That's just because the 9, 10, 11 months difference that it makes at the age of 10, 11, 12 is already big enough. Now overlay a 6-year spread onto that. And then you've got a coach who's making his pick. What's he picking? Of course, he's picking the biggest, the strongest, the fastest. And at the age of 11, 12, that says nothing about future potential. It only says about what's happened in the past. Makes sense, right?
Yeah.
That's the massive inefficiency in sport. The best athletes may never get a look in.
I think it's just like on the relative age effect. I think that's also like over the last few years, because those terms get mixed up quite a lot, and I think it's becoming more and more clear that relative age and biological maturity, they're not the same, and they operate independently. So one may be more important early on in life. That would be the relative age, whereas maturity would be more relevant when puberty hits.
Yeah, I mean, you're making decisions at 7, 8 years old. 10 months of the year is 15% of your life that you're different just by time. Now, a 12-year-old, 3 years either side because of biological factors, it's a massive, massive thing.
You can add on a 2-year age band as well. Right. Some sports, then you've got a...
So you're looking almost like a decade spread in terms of variables.
If you take the extremes, I guess, you'd end up with an 8-year difference. If you have under 14, then you'd have a 12-year-old versus a 14-year-old potentially. And then if you have the max ranges of them again, then...
The 14-year-old is actually 17 biologically, and the 12-year-old is actually 9. That's an 8-year.
But it is important to keep them a bit separate. And people mix them up all the time. Right. And I think the key is like relative age is time. So everything that exposure, chronology. You know, you do it more than it helps with time, whereas maturity is mainly genetics,
but
could be nutrition as well.
So we will park that nutrition because I wanted to get onto that a bit later. But I guess when you think about it from the perspective of who you eventually watch playing sport on a Saturday afternoon, they've made it because they have great abilities, but they've been selected out because of something in the beginning that didn't really matter, but it was the only thing we could assess. And so that population comes from a much smaller percentage or proportion of the overall population than it could have done otherwise, if we found a better way to delay that selection.
Anyway, one of the things that you've mentioned in the slides is there's a slide where you show how 12-year-olds who are at the top level and then what they do when they come to adults, a very small percentage. Just take us through that process. When does the younger group end up being at the top level in the mature group? And in other words, when you're selecting your future champions, when should you actually be looking at their potential to go through to maturity?
I mean, if you only think about biological maturity, you'd want to wait until everyone's reached the mature state, but I mean, that's not going to happen. So it's not that realistic, but that would be the ideal situation. I think, like the example you mentioned, that was from an Italian study. So they looked at high jumpers and long jumpers, and you saw the, I think it was a very poor rate of top level 13-year-olds making it to the top level at the senior level. So, and then that gets a bit better as you get to ages 16, 17, because more people probably have reached their mature state, and you can probably better say that they will also be a good adult athlete.
Yeah, so just, I did look at these figures. It's like top athletes at 12, only 10% are top athletes as adults.
Sure.
Among girls. That goes up to in the range of 50 to 60% by the time they're top athletes at 15, 16 years old. The other problem there, of course, is that by that stage, you've already invested 3 years more from 12 to 15 into coaching this athlete. And so you create a self-fulfilling prophecy. Of course, they're going to be more likely to succeed because they're the only people you've worked with. Mm-hmm. All the ones you didn't work with are now doing something else, whatever the sport is, swimming or, okay, it's not going to be swimming. That's the one you have to start very young. Triathlons, running, whatever. So that's the problem, yeah.
It's the same in sport specific. Yeah. So, you know, this example, very power-based sports, you know, long jump, high jump, but you know, it might be completely different in diving or gymnastics.
In South Africa, we have three age grade competitions where you pick national teams, which is absurd. One of them's 13, crazy, 16 also, and then 18, which is, I think, where you should do it. And I've seen the data on this is that only about 20%, 24 to be precise, of the players who are picked in our best under 13 crop are also in our best under 18 crop. That's not even into adulthood. Then it'll drop off way more, right? Because there's a massive bottleneck from youth into adult. There's only 100 professional contracts in South African rugby. But only 24% go from 13 to 18, which means that 76% vanish somewhere in the system. They're not there anymore. And so that's an example of that inefficiency.
And do you think that those people vanish really because they are biologically early maturers? I mean, I know they're probably guessing it a little bit, but is it a fair hypothesis to suggest that?
It's so complex. So that's why, like, okay, I know a bit about maturity, but, you know, it's really easy for me to associate everything that's the only thing that matters. But, like, the truth is it's so complex and, you know, people lose interest as well. Like, if you go back to just being tired of, like, being training every morning or every night, or like those things also matter, or wanting to spend more time with in school, or having to spend more time in school in some places, or just wanting to spend time with friends. So I mean, maturity plays a role in selection. I would be fairly confident in saying that, but yeah, there are definitely other factors then
explain it to 76 out of 100 vanish. I used to call them ghosts, you know, because they obviously had some early athletic ability, and maybe they still do, but now they're sort of ghosts that haunt your system with its inefficiencies. But there'll be 76 stories, you know, had to move towns, the coach passed away, money issues, whatever it is. So loads of different reasons, but there's no doubt that maturation is one of the things the system should try and control for when making those selections. That's, I think, the point. And as for parents, what would you advise then a parent of a late developing child? Like, what would you have told you? What would you have told yourself? You said you were a late developer.
I guess you really have to be patient, and you have to be very convinced that you're going to catch up later, and then you have to try to put yourself in a position where you don't lose out, because if you don't get selected to the team, you have to try to kind of think, okay, this is not the end of it. But that's really challenging. Same football. If you go to you try out with the best team in their area and you don't make it, it's very easy to say, okay, well, that didn't work. Let's quit, or let's do something else, or you end up, you know, playing by yourself, and which is less ideal than maybe playing with others. So I think just. And I think that's where a lot of these guidelines, especially in Norway, it's about keeping people in the system for as long as possible, because you don't know who's going to end up being good in the end. And there are so many ways to get to the end that you just have to keep people active.
Like, how do they do that in Norway? You mentioned Norway specifically. Yeah. How do they do that?
I think one important thing is they don't have competitions or rankings before they're 13, which is... I remember when I was 12, like we knew who was winning and losing, and we didn't maybe understand it. I think I understand it better now, but that's one way of not focusing on, you know, selection and high performance at that age.
Do you remember, do you remember we discussed this a month ago?
Yeah,
because Danny Kerr, who's an English scrum off, posted that he'd gone to his kids. He's going to watch his 13-year-old play, and they didn't have scoreboard. They just played. And we then spoke about on the podcast, you don't want to know how many Instagram and tweet messages I got saying how we woke and we soft and we PC for suggesting that that was the way to go. People don't understand that that's actually, this is the most aggressive thing you can do for performance, is to not focus on the decisions out of the result. You know what I mean? But people have become obsessed with the result. Teach them early, teach them young, they'll learn how to lose. Well, yeah, but then what?
You lose a lot of people in the process.
Exactly.
And having fun. I think, like, to me, having fun is probably the most important almost.
Exactly.
No one's going to keep doing it if they don't enjoy it. Or you have to be really strong-willed if you are. Maybe that's why I didn't make it. Because I thought it was fun, but not that fun. So I know in Norway, our whole sports system is based around parents coaching. Like, there's not a lot of professional coaches in younger age groups. Maybe more now. And maybe one good thing there is that parents are quite good at you know, understanding kids and making them feel good. There it might be the other way around as well, that they don't have the sports background, so they don't understand how to include everyone and organize training sessions.
But it sounds like parents are well informed about the strategy behind young athletes.
Yeah, I think there's a, I mean, it's difficult to compare cultures. Obviously in Norway, everyone has a really good opportunity to succeed in other areas. So no one is forced to do sports to, you know, maybe make it economically, or there isn't that incentive. So I think we're quite good at making it enjoyable. And then people do get frustrated that it's not professional enough and start, for example, football academies, and some have success with that, some don't. So but I think the overall sort of understanding is that you can be specializing from 8 and make it, and you can specialize from 20 and make it. So
it's tricky. Like, so say someone's listening to this now and they're parents of a kid in a country that plays rugby. Much trickier to keep your child as a late developer viable in rugby, because you almost have to be in a team to be able to play the games, get the coaching and so forth. I'd suggest there's other sports, particularly individual sports, where it's a little bit easier, where you can still get them the necessary support so that, as Eric says, they don't lose out. But it must be a proper dilemma for a parent whose kid at 13, 14 is just not with their peers. Enormously challenging.
I'm very much like you, Eric. In terms of my development, I was a late developer, and one of my most traumatic moments at school was when we used to stand up on at the school swimming gala, and you'd be standing there with all the lads in their speedos, and some of the guys were fully mature, and I was basically just a 9-year-old in a 14-year-old body. And emotionally, that was quite tough, because some of the guys had hairs on their chest and were shaving once a day, and I was like I had nothing. You know,
I can relate to that.
Emotionally, it was tough, and I think that's part of it. When you're young, it's really tough to deal with that, because you think you're a boy amongst men, and I imagine it's the same amongst the girls as well.
And they probably have different challenges as well.
Do they facilitate multiple participation in multiple sports as well in Norway? Because I think that's the other strategy that parents should be thinking about all the time, is given what we know about maturation and what we know at the end about how certain sports select body types and physical capabilities, the idea that you can pick a sport before you hit that maturation point is ridiculous. You got to keep your options open as long as you can.
I think we could still do better at that. I think people are very open to it until a certain age, and then when people start getting serious, maybe around 14-15, then you know, coaches put pressure to maybe quit a sport. I would say that's my understanding of the setting there. Obviously it might differ depending on where you are, but it's also a matter of, I think the coaches feel a lot of fairness issues, that if you have players who show up to every session and then you have some that, you know, play a different sport twice a week, they feel that they can't justify them also playing the same amount of time in matches. There's a lot to consider, even if it might be the ideal way forward. It doesn't mean it's the easy way in practice to do that.
I once heard the worst one I ever heard was someone saying that if you don't specialize and play one sport at 14, there's no way you can get your 10,000 hours in by the time you're 24.
Mm. Which we know is wrong.
Which is wrong. And so they were driving an agenda of 10,000 hours, which then necessitates specialization from 14. Because 10 years at 10,000 hours is 3 hours a day, basically.
Mm.
You can't do anything other than, you can barely do school if you did that. So anyway, that's how stupid
that's
people
That's been debunked quite
a
few times.
I'd hope so, but a lot of people still buy into it. So anyway, that's Talent ID, and that's how maturation informs and potentially misinforms Talent ID. Can we maybe talk a little bit about the other really fascinating area, which is how injuries in young athletes are determined in part by risks created by maturation, different stages of maturation. I think that's really fascinating.
Yeah, and I also think that's very interesting, as especially coming from I don't have a medical background, so I've never treated an injury, and I don't know the pathologies very well. But I spent a lot of time in a sports medicine clinic, in a sports academy, among physios and top level researchers and doctors. So I mean, what we kind of managed to quantify and present in a very good way is something that people have known before and have shown before, but that injury patterns change over with age and probably depending on their maturity status. So things like how mature you are in a certain part of your body might determine the type of injury you get, if that makes sense. And if you're going through a growth spurt,
fascinating, the ground up
I mean, yeah, I guess it's going back to understanding how the body matures. Mm. So typically the bones lower in the body or closer to the ground mature at an earlier age than bones higher up in the body. So the heel, for example, will mature at an earlier age than the knee and the hip. And some like the pubic apophysis or the pubic bone doesn't even fuse until, into early 20s for boys. So you can still be considered skeletally immature in some parts of your body in your 20s, whereas other parts of your body might be fully, say, mature.
Mm. Wow.
So your feet grow fastest, earliest.
Yeah, they have their growth spurt a bit quicker.
Yeah,
probably because it's weight bearing. We think evolutionary, it's probably
why. And then it sort of moves up from the ground. Heel, tibia, knee.
If you think of it like in a very average, overall way of thinking.
That's why my 5-year-old daughters have to change her shoes every 5 minutes, because she's great. So the feet, and so you think it's evolutionary wise, that was the reason why it's from the ground up is purely because you want to be stronger from the ground up, because that's where the impact is.
I wouldn't know, but that would be my guess.
And then injuries, like obviously now you get like Osgood Schlatter's at the knee. There was one at the heel with
Sever's disease.
That's the one.
Yeah, so you get these typical, like, you call them growth related injuries. Because they've been associated with a period where you grow fast, and it's essentially the growth plates. So it's kind of the areas in the body where the growth happens, both in length but also in shape. Those areas are a bit more vulnerable, so they might be vulnerable both to overuse. So you might get irritations, or you call it apophysitis, but also they're also vulnerable to like large forces that might like peel off or tear off a part of the bone. So that is considered a vulnerable site in immature athletes. So you see more of those injuries in athletes who aren't fully mature.
So young girl gymnast, quite a high load, landing, running, jumping all the time. I think it's fairly obvious that loading will increase the risk of injury. Does it change the growth of the maturation pattern of the skeleton?
So I think in extreme cases it might. I think the consensus now is that training isn't dangerous for growth, and same with strength training doesn't stunt your growth.
That was
going to
be my next question.
As long as it's supervised and by trained or practitioners who know basic training principles of progression.
So the risk is more an injury, a chronic or an acute injury, than it is a stunting of growth.
I mean, you could like you have these growth plates that determine your, or that are responsible for your growth in length. If they, for example, get a fracture through it, right. Or if you have an extreme load that disturbs the blood supply, then that might, you know, lead to some growth disturbances. But again, I don't think it's the main concern for most people. But but yeah, you've seen that in divers, for example, or gymnasts in their wrists, a lot of loading on their growth plates in the wrists, and climbers in their fingers, shoulders in baseball. So there might be disturbances to growth. Like that is something you have to consider, worst case.
So for example, if my child, daughter, son is a runner, I'm just hypothesizing here, they are more likely to be mature at an earlier age as somebody using the lower half of their body than somebody that is participating, as you just mentioned, in something like baseball, where they have to throw a ball or play a racket sport or something like that, where there is, I mean, is that a bit of a stretch to?
Yeah, I think it's mainly genetics. Okay. I wouldn't. I don't think the sport would affect your maturity or your progression of maturity. But it might predispose you or make you more selectable if you want to certain sports. But
the reason why I'm mentioning it is if I have a son or a daughter that's very good at, say, for instance, golf or a racket sport. And they suddenly get a shoulder injury. Do you have to be more aware of that when they're younger, because they are more susceptible to those injuries when they're younger? Because if they were runners, they'd be more mature in their lower bodies, because that's the area where they are maturing more faster.
I think it's just different injury types. I think people can agree or disagree. I don't think children should be necessarily always training or competing with pain. So I don't think that's a good thing in general. It might be different types of pain. Like if you're a rugby player, maybe collision pain is something you have to deal with. But you know, it's probably something that's not, you know, going to cause problems down the line. But when it comes to these growth related injuries, you know, it's probably easier to modify early on rather than letting it develop and then you have a problem that lasts for longer, because there are some good studies out of Denmark that show that kids who have knee pain at a younger age also struggle with it later on. So so you can have those long-lasting impacts, and also some, you know, stress fractures that are considered high risk that, you know, you want to take it seriously, and maybe you don't have to take time off, but I would say it's probably nice to see a health professional at some point.
So in other words, the word is, if you've got a young athlete with any kind of injury, caution is key. Don't push them through it.
Yeah, I mean, to me, that's where it's difficult to me as not a non-medical practitioner. I wouldn't be giving any health advice, but it's, you know, it's, I think pain is usually a warning sign, and you know, that's something you should take seriously and at least monitor and maybe have it checked out too.
So the most so coming back to the injuries, you did your PhD on injuries in youth footballers and how maturation affects it. What were the high level findings there, if you just sum it up?
So I mean, we see that injury types depend on age. So typically, injuries to the skeleton and growth related injuries, they peak around under 13, under 14, and then they get less and less common, where muscle injuries follow the other opposite pattern, so they get more and more common. That kind of it aligns well with the theoretical background and some studies looking at maturity and injuries, where you see that it's the different injury types that change. So an immature athlete will get different injuries from a mature athlete. And it comes back to the vulnerability of these growth plates, probably, where different structures are the weak link. Let's say if you have a chain, muscle, tendon, bone, and you pull in that, like which part is going to break first? And in an immature athlete, it's probably the bone attachment or the growth plate, whereas in a mature athlete, it might be the muscle or the tendon.
Yeah, interesting. And then you talked to, when you, Ross, you were going to touch a bit on the nutrition side. I mean,
In terms of modifiable factors that can change this, I'd imagine nutrition would be quite an important one in a young athlete.
Yeah, I think like most people say, okay, this is a non-modifiable risk factor because it's mainly genetic. And then that's why it's interesting, like here in South Africa, it might be a modifiable risk factor because parts of what determines your maturity is that you have adequate and healthy nutrition and not everyone has that. Whereas in Norway or where I was doing my PhD in Qatar, that wasn't necessarily an issue at all. Everyone had enough food. So your environment does play a role. And there have been studies looking at that in South Africa, not in sports, but where you see that there are differences between ethnicities, which I would assume and the authors assumed were because of their socioeconomic status, which again relates to nutrition potentially.
But here it'll be pathology. Massively confounded in this country.
Illnesses and nutrition.
That's what makes South Africa quite interesting to study. I've seen, I don't know whether you have, and maybe I'm misremembering it, but there's data that skeletal health, and this might be a distinct thing from maturation, is affected even by the mother's nutrition while in the womb. That there's Lisa Micklesfield, who's a researcher here. I'm pretty sure I have this right. And she was doing a thing called the bone health study and started off as a birth to 20. They tracked these kids from birth up to 20 years old. It's probably now a birth to 40 study. It's one of these massive longitudinal data sets. And I very distinctly remember her saying that there was evidence that malnutrition in the mother during those 9 months was a major predictor of the skeletal health at the age of 5 or 6.
Sure.
So it seems to me like it would make a difference in extreme circumstances, and that's why I thought it interesting.
How close do you think we are to a place where, and you've talked a little bit about the fact that you can't do invasive studies on radiation on kids and that sort of thing. We've talked a bit about the fact that Ross is working with Ilana Meyer and working with this group of athletes, young athletes who are potentially going to be future champions here in South Africa. Is there a way that we can say, right, here's a 14-year-old and we are going to do these studies and we're going to choose that one over that one because of this factor? I mean, how close are we to getting to that point? And is that the sort of holy grail of youth development?
Again, it comes back to, okay, we have to put this in context. Biological maturity is one small part of this. So whether it's the holy grail, I don't know. Like, to me and my world right now, which are all around research on this topic, it's the holy grail. But I think we have to be honest and say that there's a lot of other things that play a bigger role.
You can't just do a muscle biopsy and say, right, that person's ahead.
But we can. So I think my angle on this is, There are ways to get an indication of where you are in your maturity process, and if you have those available, then why would you not try to use it? Now you have to trust it, and you have to be aware of the limitations with those methods. It's an estimate; it's not perfect, but I think it is one important piece to add in. And like I said, you can now do it with ultrasound. But it is expensive as well. You aren't going to get any club going to. They aren't just going to pay for that because it's too expensive, and it's probably other things. Yeah, they probably should invest in other things like equipment or coaches. Yeah.
So comment on that. But before I make that comment, let me ask it this way: if you gave some really good coaches 50 athletes to look at. How accurately are coaches able to gauge biological maturation without needing some sophisticated test? Or is it actually sometimes quite difficult to see?
There was one study done in Germany on that. And they found that sports scientists and coaches, they, on average, they're quite good at guessing skeletal age. But you would expect that because on average, it makes sense. But the variations on an individual level was a bit poor, and they tend to underestimate the very early maturing and overestimate the late maturing. So everyone's kind of a bit more grouped in the middle. So I think you can get a good idea just looking at someone if they're early or late.
And performances, right? Two 14-year-olds and an 800. 157, 207. Okay. There's a chance the 157 is an earlier maturer, but by itself that's not enough, right? Because maybe that person's been training for 4 years, so it's a training age effect, not a biological age effect. Yeah. So So you've got to take into account, and plus there's just inherent differences that may never be ironed out. So you can never proceed on the assumption that he'll catch up. Might never be able to, because he's just a different human. The reason I ask is because, you know, I represented, as we said, to our coaches. And the coaches say, we kind of already know who's the early maturer.
Mm.
So we might not need the tool. Mm. And I'm saying, well, then let the tool confirm what you thought.
Mm.
And if it doesn't confirm what you thought, maybe that's the one you really need to pay attention to. You know what I mean? Like,
I get that,
But I can see that there's an ethical argument or dilemma that you might create if you overvalue the tool, right?
Yeah, I think that's the same with any test, I guess, you use to make big decisions. Like, you've got to be pretty certain that it's important and that it's accurate before you make a big decision, like selecting someone and bringing them in. Like in this case, to a high school program, it's a bursary program, right? So it has big implications, and you've got to be pretty sure that your test is good.
So I suppose my specific, and this is me now talking from the EnduroCAD side, is, specific concern would be that if you use the tool and you don't respect its limitations and understand the context in which that result exists, it might prejudicially exclude someone whose life might have been changed as a consequence of not having the tool. You know, so then it becomes actually not so good, a force for harm, actually.
Yeah.
But then the same is true in the other direction, right? What if we didn't pick someone who we would have based on the tool? Then we needed it. So.
Yeah, it's a tool. I think that's where, all it is, right? That's where it's been, right? Especially power speed-based sports have preferred early maturing athletes, and like there's been studies in football from the Aspire Academy in Manchester United, where you see at under 10, under 9 level, there's no difference between the percentage of early and late maturers, but then when you get to under 18, I think it's up to 80% are early maturing.
That's cool. So can I just pause on that? At 10. And in this instance, maturing is measured by the X-ray.
That's skeletal age,
Skeletal age. So by the time they get to like the end of their sort of adolescent phase, the early maturers are massively overrepresented. So just for the sake of completeness, explain what's happened in those intervening 8 years.
Well, potentially, most likely, the ones who have matured earlier, they look better, they perform better. Mm. So they're selected, and others are either kicked out or not reselected. So then you end up with this huge maturity bias.
And also they've been developed. Those early maturers have now been developed on top of the
fact. It's a cumulative effect as well. It's the same, you can say, with a relative age effect as well, but that's from early childhood on, where if you always get the attention and the focus, then maybe you might end up being a bit better. Even if you're deselected or selected at a later stage, you might have those benefits with you. So I guess coming back to the point, like the problem is that there is in most places a maturity bias. So people do tend to not favor the late maturing athlete. So it's kind of rooting for the one who's not left out and giving him a chance.
It's me and you, Eric.
Yeah.
Which fundamentally, the reason for which fundamentally boils down to the incentive of the person making that selection is too immediate. That coach at Manchester United has to pick for now, not for 5 years down the line.
Well, we talked about
He's going to be evaluated on the basis of the performances in the next year, not the ones 5 years later.
But we know at Premier League level in the UK now, they're picking kids that are 6 years old for their youth development programs. Mm. As you said, the chances of them making the senior team 12, 13, 14 years later is minuscule.
So that's a really interesting economic. That's a really interesting economic model, because picking them that young is cheap.
Mm.
And so they're willing to say, I'll pick 100, and I don't mind if 99 blow out, because the one that doesn't...
99 will blow out.
Well, I don't care, because the one that doesn't... And if I didn't pick 100, and the one is in the 100 I didn't pick, and Arsenal picks him, then I lose out.
Mm.
So there's opportunity cost and economic... It's the same as buying a company like shares early when they list, as opposed to buying the shares of an Apple. You know, you want to try and buy it early because you can afford to lose out.
The scary thing from a parent's perspective is that you look at young talented athletes, you know, you've got an 8, 9, 10-year-old son or daughter that's beating their peers in races. And then you think, okay, well, what's the process that I must go through now for them to, first of all, enjoy what they do, second of all, to make sure they don't get injured or any sort of physical harm. And I've seen so many in my two sons growing up, they've had friends that have been way ahead of them on certain sports. My son is a very good cyclist, but he had people of 14, 15 years of age who were being coached professionally. By 19, they're gone. They're not even in the system anymore. And yet my son has continued. He was a late developer. So it's an interesting one, because as parents, when you see our kids develop and they look like they've got talent at 10 years old, you want them to continue that talent path.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is, fine, continue it. But remember that it only matters when you're 15, 16.
And therefore keep the options open and the things they're not necessarily.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And it's also like you might need different challenges. So we tend to think about the poor late maturing athlete, but you know, the early maturing athlete also faces a lot of challenges. Like,
yeah,
if you've always been winning and then suddenly everyone starts catching up with you, that's a really big challenge. It might, yeah, your motivation might take a hit.
The worst thing is when you're a 14-year-old boy and you go to cross country and it's girls and boys in the same race and you get beaten by all the girls.
Yeah.
Because the girls are literally stronger than the same age boys.
It's like cross country skiing, I was beaten by everyone, so that's fine. Yeah.
But this early developer thing, because we've focused a lot so far in this conversation on the late developer and how we can keep him or her viable in the system. The early developer is the 76% of those rugby players or the 90% of those high jumpers who become what I called earlier the ghosts. So one of the other dilemmas for people now is, what do you, can you do anything with that person, do you think, that respects the fact that they're early developers and then helps keep them in the system for longer?
Yeah, and I think this comes back to the, like, as a basic training principle of individualization.
Yeah.
Like, everyone needs, as far as possible, to be challenged based on where they are and their background. So it's really kind of that simple. But one way you can do that is to, you can adjust your training plans according to maturity, because some training might be more or less, you might place more or less emphasis on it depending on how far along in your maturity or maturation you are. But you can also group athletes based on maturity and timing of the growth spurt. So you might, there's been some good research on that in football in England, for
Cummings,
example.
Cummings, eh?
Yeah.
It's called biobanding.
Yeah, exactly.
So you band them by their biological age as far as you can, yeah.
And then that's where you, so instead of playing under 14, under 16, under 18, you might have a group that's, depending on your, if you use the percentage of adult height, which is quite quite often used, you might group them from, yeah, say 85 to 90 or 95 to and up together, so that you play with those who are biologically matched. And then they did a study where they looked at how they perceived that, and it seemed like it was well received among both the early and the late, because they were challenged in different areas. So the early maturing athlete will now not be able to rely on his or her strength and power. You can't just run over your opponents. You have to be more technical, tactical. And the later maturing athletes, they now suddenly they have freedom to display their other abilities, technical abilities. So I think that can be, again, it's really challenging because you need a sufficient number of athletes within those different groups. So maybe that's where you might go multiple clubs together or teams together and organize a tournament like that.
It's interesting to think, though, that being the early maturist creates disadvantages for you, because you never need to learn a set of skills that the other folk have to. So your skill and your tactical awareness and your decision making may never be refined. And then when you lose this physical advantage, all the kids who've come up behind you have got skills you'll never have developed. So.
Which is very much a big problem in the South African rugby system in many ways.
Yeah. And New Zealand. Like, so in New Zealand, for instance, they do weight banding in some regions and in some competitions. And World Rugby gets asked often why we don't recommend weight banding in all countries around the world. It's because we don't run community rugby in all countries around the world. But there are also other considerations, because imagine, again, you're a three-year split. You're going to have, well, 6 years actually, but let's say three, you'll have a 12, 13-year-old playing against 16, 17-year-olds, and now they're emotionally different humans, even if they might be physically quite similar. So then you remove people from their peers, and that's the counter-arguments to this. So it gets much more complex than you think. But I would think it's definitely worth exploring, because you have to have, the challenge has to be there at the level of the person's development.
Yeah, and I think in either case, you have to explain this quite well, because you're probably going to get parents who come to you and like, why is my kid playing with a 10-year-old when he's 14?
Last one on the early developers. like everyone, well, not everyone, but most people will be familiar with the idea of like the suddenly clumsy, awkward looking, goofy looking teenager, because that's driven by growth.
Yeah. So there is this concept, it's been called like adolescent awkwardness.
Yeah.
So it's, it doesn't happen.
That's not social. Yeah. That's not social awkwardness.
I remember it well.
No, you're talking about the social awkwardness you felt. Both. You felt when you were standing on the pool deck with all those hairy 14-year-olds.
Emotional awkwardness. Yeah. No, it's more, I guess, more the physical side where, you know, you change your body dimensions and your body composition changes so much over a short period of time that you struggle doing what you used to be able to do very easily. Mm. And again, that typically you can see that around the peak height velocity rate of highest growth, where performance might then be affected by the fact that you're adjusting to a new body. So again, that's something that could play a role in injury risk, but it's also something that could play a role when you determine or look at performance and want to select. So if you select and a guy's going through or a girl goes through the growth spurt, like they might be at a disadvantage just because they're in that little phase. And it's also really challenging if you have adolescents who perform well and, you know, they progress and suddenly they don't progress anymore. They might even get worse.
Mm.
And then you try to overcompensate by, okay, well, I got to do more. And then, you know, you increase your training load intensity, you end up getting injured or burnt out. So again, I think it's about patience, but it's also, maybe it's a good time to focus on some alternative training, a bit more, say, fundamental movement skills, some balance, maybe some flexibility. And yeah, maybe be a bit careful with your like super high intensity exercises.
Yeah, that's good advice.
Yeah. Last one for me, like you're obviously doing this research and that's how we have our sort of conversations and how this came about. For what are the two or three main research questions that you feel need to be answered in the next couple of years to advance our understanding of this subject?
I think there's a huge gap in understanding girl sport or female sport. There's very little done in terms of both performance and injury risk. One challenge with that might be the fact that they mature earlier, which means you have to kind of catch them earlier in your research project, which is really challenging when you get to the younger ages. But I think that's a massive gap that we don't really know much about. Mm. I think in general, maybe the getting a bit more rigor in the studies. I think now there are so many academies and clubs taking measures over time that you might be able to get really good quality studies rather than using these estimation equations that have been criticized. So I think just getting more high quality studies over time, you really need to just try to follow someone over time if you want to really understand it. It's okay to get a bit of an understanding just following a team for one season, but what you really need is like long-term solid studies. I don't know. To me, personally, I think the African context is underexplored as well. Mm. Like it's people say genetics may play a role, may not. All the methods used are based on reference samples, mostly from Caucasian individuals, which means that anything you're estimating assumes that your individual or athlete can be considered similar to that, and I don't think we really know if that's true. So, I mean, maybe me being in South Africa, obviously, that's something I want to work on.
Hmm. Fascinating, Eric. Thanks very much for your time, and look forward to seeing some more research come out and let us know what you discover. How long are you here in South Africa for?
Yeah,
indefinitely. Or?
Yeah, I've got a contract until the end of 2025, so
okay.
I guess that's my plan so far.
And you might just stay here, and we'll go back. It's warmer here, isn't it?
Yeah, the weather is a lot better here than Norway. So,
all right, thanks very much for your time.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on Twitter at SportsciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport podcast.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact,
you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.